Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and at least one Democratic congressman came back from summer break today to announce he can no longer back a health reform bill with a public plan. Mike Ross of Arkansas said he changed his mind after hearing from constituents this summer, and that doesn't bode well for President Obama, who needs as many Democrats on board his health care reform proposal as possible. The president will address a joint session of Congress tomorrow as new proposals to charge insurance companies fees or create low-cost, low coverage for people under 25 are considered today. Gail Chadwick is congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Let's check in with you first, Gail, to see where we are here. Is, for instance, Representative Ross alone in this? He is a blue dog conservative Democrat. Is this surprising that he's announcing this vote?
No, not at all. In fact, he is most certainly not alone, and that is the president's problem right now. Many Democrats went home to scorching town meetings. Now, even if all of them weren't as bad as the ones that were televised, it sent an impression, you know, through anyone vulnerable. And remember, all House members are up for re-election. Typically, the members in a president's party lose in a midterm election. That's been true in all recent cases, except for two. So this is a very sensitive point. Are we with the public on this, or are they losing us? They also can read polls. There has been a drop of in double-digit numbers of the people who believe that the government can do a better job than insurance companies in providing health care. That's a very tough number for this president to deal with.
Well, and you've been talking to people who've been saying what we've been hearing towards the end of the summer, that President Obama may have made some compromises early on in forging his health care proposals, compromises with big pharmaceuticals, compromises with lobbyists on K Street, but he got outmaneuvered out on the street, out in these town hall meetings.
That's it. He learned too well the lessons of the Clinton health care debacle in 93-94. The Clintons did it themselves in small groups without working through the Congress, and they were clobbered by K Street. So President Obama comes in with people around him who remember that period all too well, and they immediately work with K Street, cut some deals, and they give the ball to Congress. Do what you can. Work your will on it. Now, those lessons may have been fine initially, but when it came to the summer, they realized that they also needed a grassroots strategy, and that just wasn't there yet.
Well, and we hasten to add that some would say he also got clobbered by K Street out on the street, because some of these, you know, movements across the country that ended up in town hall meetings were funded by lobbyists and were filled with disinformation. Either way, a lot of people have questions. And today, the six senators on the Finance Committee, the only committee still trying to hammer out a proposal, are conferring. This is the Senate committee. Committee Chair Max Baucus has come out with a new set of proposals. We mentioned imposing a fee on insurance companies to help finance coverage. There's also expanding Medicaid, establishing insurance exchanges where small groups and individuals can buy policies. But seemingly notable by its absence, I don't think there's any public option.
There is not. And the other thing that is very important about that proposal is that it is the Baucus proposal. In the past, when the Finance Committee has weighed in and been a very important player, it's been the Baucus-Grassley proposal, Grassley being the top Republican on that panel.
Chuck Grassley of Iowa. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. The senator, from what he said this morning, is not with this proposal. It doesn't cut enough money, he said. He's looking for something in the range of $700 billion, not $900 billion. He's very uncomfortable with the public option in any way, shape, or form, and he sees even something like a proposal that's been floated by another Republican, Olympia Snowe, a trigger mechanism, as unacceptable because it could lead to a public option.
Let me explain that, because this is a good thing you bring up. This is a proposal that would trigger a public option down the road. If, for instance, not enough people in rural areas were covered by the proposal that was passed, it would trigger a public option down the road.
Exactly.
But is there anything that President Obama, in the mind of analysts there in Washington, can say in tomorrow night's speech before Congress that heads off the reconciliation, the idea that Democrats would have to forego a filibuster-proof 60-vote vote to pass a health care bill and instead have less votes and pass a bill, but then every controversial item in the bill would have to be reconciled in the budget. Is there anything that you think he can say tomorrow night that'll turn this around?
I think he can do two things. He can really appeal to the moderates. He's going to need them in his own party. He's going to need some Republicans to move over. But he's also appealing over the head of those members of Congress to their constituents. And he has in the past been able to do this successfully. It's been tougher in the White House, but this is a real test. Can he move the grassroots, which is the ultimate test of the effectiveness of a president? Members don't so much listen to what the president says. They listen to how what the president says affects what their constituents think. And that's really the big stake tonight. The other thing that I think is going to be, or rather tomorrow night, the other thing that's going to be very interesting is whether he can detoxify reconciliation. Now, it's been used many times before. Republicans used it for their tax cuts. Democrats have used it as well.
Because one of the things about reconciliation is that it only lasts for 5 years when you push a bill through that way. That's why tax cuts are going to lapse. But
that's
go ahead.
Right.
Yeah.
That's right. It has all sorts of difficulties, and it also makes the Senate parliamentarian, who none of us would pick out of a police lineup, briefly the most important person in Washington, because he's the one who rules on all of these procedural motions. It's going to be a civics lesson if Democrats actually to try to do this on the floor, because it will be one kind of point of order after another that the parliamentarian will rule on.
Well, we'll see if that happens. Gail Chadha, congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, thank you as always.
You're welcome.
I can support the president. I can support an action against Saddam Hussein.
If I had been president in 2003, I never would have started this war.
Well, she's flipping, she's flopping. No, she's not flipping and flopping. She's lying.
Well, her supporters say the scathing film about Hillary Clinton and her 2008 campaign for president is filled with distortions. But that's not why it's getting a rare rerun before the Supreme Court tomorrow. At issue is whether Hillary the movie violates federal campaign finance laws, which bar corporations from paying for campaign ads. Tomorrow's case is also significant because it's the first case before new Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor, and it's a case that made for some strange bedfellows. Emily Bazelon is legal affairs editor for Slate. Emily, this case is Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission, was argued before the Supreme Court back in March. So first, why do they want this re-argument?
Well, the justices seem to think this case is a potential vehicle for a much broader ruling that potentially would knock down a major part of campaign finance reform as Congress passed it in the McCain-Feingold Act in 2002. And what's at issue here is whether corporations and unions can independently spend money to advocate for candidates. So they still wouldn't be able to give money to candidates during the weeks right before an election, but they would be able to spend money on their own ads advocating for those candidates.
Well, you mentioned the McCain-Feingold Act, the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act of 2002. There was also a Supreme Court decision on corporate spending in 1990. So go deeper there. Remind us, what is the law?
And the states, actually particularly the states since the 1890s, have been trying to limit the influence of business in campaigns. And in 1990, the Supreme Court upheld a ban in Michigan against corporations spending money independently in the window of weeks before an election. So in order to let Citizens United and advocacy groups like it and unions and businesses pay for attack ads like this long potential broadcast that was attacking Hillary, the Supreme Court would have to overturn that 1990 decision. And it would also have to overturn a decision it issued in 2003 that upheld a similar part of McCain-Feingold. That's the part of McCain-Feingold that says that corporations and businesses can't give money for ads that mention the name of a candidate in the weeks before an election.
But is the argument also made that McCain-Feingold really refers to television advertisement as opposed to something like this film, which wasn't really shown anywhere?
Right. So that's the narrow way that everyone thought this case was going to come out, that it was really just a case about whether you could broadcast these kinds of attack documentaries on television or over the internet or issue them on DVD. And the court could still go in that direction. But what it asked for new briefs on is this broader question about whether it should overturn the ban Congress passed on independent financing of campaign ads by businesses and unions in the weeks leading up to an election. action.
And not just quibble about whether this movie really is an ad, but whether or not corporations should have any financing of ads or films or anything.
Exactly.
Well, go a little deeper. What do those against corporate financing of things like Hillary the movie, what do they say?
Well, they say, look, there's a practical political argument here about turning vast sums of corporate money over into elections and making the link between big business and politics even stronger than we have, and creating a real sense of quid pro quo where candidates know that these businesses can spend vast sums on their behalf, and so they're really beholden to these businesses as they come into office.
Right. Well, as we said, this is made for strange bedfellows. The American Civil Liberties Union is siding with the National Rifle Association, supporting Citizens United. Again, that's the corporation that made the film. And the prominent First Amendment lawyer Floyd Abrams is representing Republican Senator Mitch McConnell, who's an opponent of campaign finance laws. What is someone like Floyd Abrams, again seen as sort of a more liberal lawyer, what is he saying in support of someone who's an opponent of campaign finance laws?
Well, if you are a purist about the First Amendment, then you think that everybody should be able to speak in a political campaign. And in the 1980s, the Supreme Court issued a big decision called Buckley versus Vallejo, in which it said very clearly that it considers money to be speech in the context of a political campaign. So if that's your premise, if you see money as speech, and then you think that the best way to deal with speech in an election is just to have everybody talk as loudly as they can by spending as much money as they want to, then you're against these kinds of bans, whether you are on the right or on the left.
We understand that the ACLU has the same stand, that it's a matter of free speech, but this has caused quite a rift within the ACLU.
Because the other way of thinking about this is that there's something very corrupting about having these unlimited streams of money going into the election cycle from advocacy groups, and that the distinction between not being able to give money directly to a candidate for corporations and unions versus being able to pay for all these ads that support them anyway is a meaningless distinction.
Well, Emily Bazelon, you've already said that you don't think that the court is going to rule narrowly, in other words, rule just on whether this movie is not covered by McCain-Feingold because it's a movie people choose to see as opposed to an ad that they have no choice. It just comes at them. You think that there might be more of a broad attempt to rule overall on whether or not corporations can be involved in financing. What do you think is going to happen?
Three justices of the Supreme Court, Scalia, Thomas, and Kennedy, have made it clear that they think this part of campaign finance reform is wrong. Roberts and Alito have also indicated they're not so thrilled with the Supreme Court's prior rulings in this area either. And so it looks like certainly there could be the five votes to overturn these prior rulings and really open up the spigot of campaign spending. We don't know anything about the new justice, Sonia Sotomayor, Your views on this matter.
Emily Bazelon, legal affairs editor for Slate, also editor of Double X, that's Slate's new website for women. Emily, thanks as always.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, just ahead, colleges say if you build deluxe dorms, students will come. That's in 1 minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to Here and Now. Remember when a college dorm room was a 4x4 concrete cell with bad lighting and communal bathrooms? Well, times have changed. Boston University, where we're based, has elegant new high-rise dorms with stunning views, walk-in closets, giant flat-screen TVs in common areas. The university even hired workers to help students move in.
The views from the 26th floor study lounge are incredible, and a lot of the parents who I saw on move-in day were just in awe of this building. I know my mom was. It's nice to know that we're probably living in the best dorm in the country right now, and it's awesome.
That's BU junior Chuck Giroux. Yahoo has rated his dorm the best in the country. But the University of Houston's $107 million Calhoun lofts have floor-to-ceiling windows. And Florida Southern's college new dorms are based on designs by the late architect Frank Lloyd Wright. What's going on? Jeff Salingo is editor of the Chronicle of Higher Education. Jeff, first, why are BU's new dorms considered the best in the country?
Well, they have some of the best amenities in the country, but most colleges are catching up. There are a number of institutions like BU that are basically replacing all of their dorms, most of which were built in the 1960s when there was the last big baby boom generation to come through colleges. So BU may be special now because they have individual suites and great bathrooms and great views and
soundproof piano rooms. What else have they got?
Well, the other thing that they're doing is that BU, like many other colleges these days, they're using dorms as learning communities as well. So these are not just places where students go sleep and maybe study. They're actually learning there as well. There's professors living in these dorms. There are classes happening in these dorms. There are public lectures happening in these dorms. So these are not just traditional places where students go to sleep and socialize. This is also where they're spending a bulk of their day.
Right, in 24-hour reading rooms, there's media rooms with big flat-screen TVs. There's washers and dryers programmed to alert the students via their computers
when the wash is done.
I mean, why are schools doing this?
Expectations. I think that the student that you had on basically said he was in awe and his parents were in awe, and I think that's the big difference here. Parents expect these things as well because this is a generation coming to college now that had their own room at home. You know, they didn't have to share with somebody. They probably even had their own bathroom. So they don't want to come to college and have to share it with another student, not only a room, but they definitely don't want to have a communal bathroom like many of us who went to colleges years ago had.
Well, but this is leading to a lot of criticism. The Boston Globe covered the new BU dorms, and some people wrote in. Bruce Jones, who described himself as the New England admission officer for an elite West Coast liberal arts school, wrote, BU has institutionalized gradations of affluence. It makes me want to stick two fingers down my throat. Saul Gittleman wrote, it means we separate students on the basis of wealth as soon as they get into these rooms. Not my idea of education. Is there that danger that you're setting up a class structure at school? Because these BU dorms, at least, cost students $13,000 a year. That's about $5,000 more than the standard dorms.
There is that problem. But in some ways, this problem has existed for a while. There were some dorms that were always better than others. Back in the good old days, there were singles that cost more than doubles. So you always had this kind of gradation on college campuses. Obviously, this takes it to a whole new level.
Right. Well, and Boston University President Robert Brown has said that what they're trying to do is house more of their undergrads. It's happened across the country that schools haven't had room. They've had to put students up in hotels. I think this is the first year that BU has been able to put every student who wants on-campus housing on campus, in part because of these high-rise dorms. This is part of a very long transformation from being a commuter school to trying to send the message out that this is a residential college. Are other schools building this kind of housing with that same thinking?
Yes, and they're trying to improve it, again, because of their competitors. When students and parents go on college tours, one of the things they look at is not just the classrooms and the majors and student life, but the big part of it is, what do the dorms look like? Where am I going to be living? And this is particularly true in urban areas like Boston, where the competition for not only for students among all the colleges up there is fierce, but students also have trouble finding housing if they had to live off campus. So one of the reasons that many of these schools in cities want to bring their students back on campus is that there's not a lot of good housing options, especially cheap housing options off campus. And it also helps with their town-gown relationships. Local neighbors would prefer more of these students living on campus than living in residential neighborhoods.
Right, and the more that live on campus, the more housing there is in the neighborhoods for other people. Well, the University of Houston is another school trying to build its on-campus community by building these luxury dorms. But you mentioned that there's an expectation. This is a generation of kids, perhaps, that had their own room. And that leads to the other criticism, that this is coddling kids, you know, and that they're going to graduate and they're going to have to go back to that, you know, one-room, low-rent place with their first job.
Robin, I think that coddling has happened probably much sooner than before they built these luxury dorms. I mean, we are in this generation now of helicopter parents, this term where parents are, you know, talking to their sons or daughters every day, finding out, you know, what grades do they get? And if they didn't get a good grade, they call the professor up. They call, you know, some days now they're even emailing or calling the president. So there there is a lot of coddling happening on college campuses on a number of things. And it does set up a lot of expectations when students graduate. We're seeing that now in probably one of the worst economies in decades. We had this great big class graduate last spring. Many of them are not working in their fields. Many of them don't even have jobs and have had to move home. And many of them are saying, what have I done? I've just gone to school for 4 years. I had this expectation, almost this entitlement, that I would have a job, and they didn't. So, you know, just add a dorm to the list of many things that colleges have been doing to coddle students.
Well, Chuck, the BU student we heard from to start off, he said he's paying for his high-rise luxury dorm room in part with some private student loans. So he's racking up debt to pay for that room. But he might not want to get used to it because when he gets out in the real world, that apartment with its views would cost him a lot more. Jeff Salingo, editor of the Chronicle of Higher Education, thanks so much for speaking with us.
No problem. It was great to be here.
Okay, quick note, tomorrow on Here and Now, he followed the band Fish around, then discovered Judaism, and became a musician himself. We'll speak with Grammy-nominated artist Matis Yahu, that's tomorrow. Still ahead today, that 17-year-old Melanie Udan making such a splash at Flushing Meadows. That's after the latest news, Here and Now. Music and manners, that's the mantra at a new school in Baghdad. The Academy of Peace Through Art brings children of all backgrounds together to teach them music, but also to revive something the founders of the school believe many young people have lost during the war, good manners. Dozens of teenagers come to the school every day to learn how to open doors for others, play musical instruments, but also make dinner table conversation. The BBC's Natalia Antalava reports.
Ismail is 12. He plays not just the clarinet, but also piano. And he is among 150 children who come every day to the center set up by Karim Wasfi, the director of Iraq's National Symphony Orchestra.
From day one, I said you could experience the effect of a Kalashnikov, a clock, a Berta, a weapon in your hand, or the effect of an instrument in your hand. The effect is much better than a bullet. So try playing an instrument. And we're offering a space, we're offering professionals, we're offering instruments. 1, 2, 3, and...
But in Iraq, this music can also be considered un-Islamic. Both teachers and students here have been threatened. Yusuf says he has been beaten by a militia for carrying his guitar, and yet he keeps coming back.
Of course, it's a risk. Sometimes I go in battle-round areas. Yeah, there's still battle-round areas. So it's a little bit risk for me. I don't know what's going to, car explode or something like that, but I don't care. I don't care. Even if it's a very big risk, I'm going to come here to continue learning something good for me.
Music is not the only thing they offer. Teachers say politeness is one of many things Iraqi teenagers have lost during the war. And so classes in etiquette and manners are mandatory here.
It's manners slash human interaction, human relations, and even social manners, eating manners, everything. They cover everything.
Even eating manners.
And, you know, in certain cases.
To much amusement, the teacher calls on volunteers to come forward. The lesson is about how a man must go about kissing a lady's hand. Don't grab too harsh, she instructs the boys. Don't bow too low. In this conservative society, it may seem like a relatively useless skill, but students love it. Hint is one of them.
Our professors, they're very helpful with us. It's very useful. They're teaching us about how we contact with each other and how we are looking about our society.
Hint's next class, she tells me, is in civil interaction. In other words, a lesson in how to have a conversation without turning it into a confrontation. And while she rushes off, Karim Wasfi, the director, offers to show me the classrooms upstairs.
Where is the music coming from?
It's coming from furious in the class. Someone seems to be improvising. There you go. Someone is improvising. Enjoying some nice
coffee. Are they missing etiquette classes?
Yeah, deliberately.
in trouble for skipping the etiquette class, two teenage boys offer to play for their headmaster. It does the trick. The director is clearly impressed.
That's not bad, actually. Kind of surprising. Then you are free to miss the etiquette lesson if you're playing.
All students here say music is what gets them through the violence and chaos of their daily lives. This center is a bit of an escape, a welcome break from the reality of living and surviving in Baghdad.
That report from the BBC's Natalia Antalava in Baghdad. Well, just ahead, we'll have a check-in on the biggest story of the U.S. Open. Also, one of the biggest stories ever in sports, but one that maybe you never heard of. It's the woman who helped get Americans swimming. That's after the break, here and now. Players have been asked not to tweet from courtside, and we promise not to give away any of today's action. But we have to check in on the biggest story from the U.S. Open in Flushing Meadows in New York with John Wertheim, senior writer for Sports Illustrated. And John, we are, of course, talking about the 17-year-old Melanie Udan. How big a story is she?
She's made everybody forget that Roger Federer and Serena Williams and Rafael Nadal are playing. I mean, she's really hijacked this event. She's from Georgia, which probably doesn't hurt that she has this American pedigree, but she's really been playing phenomenal tennis, and suddenly, you know, she could very easily get to the finals of this whole event.
As it is, she's the youngest woman at 17 to reach the quarterfinals since Serena Williams did it 10 years ago. And she was ranked 70 in the world and pulled out victories now against top seeds. Who is she facing?
Well, she's beaten Elena Dementieva, who, you know, Olympic gold medalist, Maria Sharapova, former number one, who won this. And she's also about 5'6", which makes her a munchkin in women's tennis these days. So I think that's part of the appeal, too, that she's not one of these carbon copy, big hitting women. I mean, I think the variety of her game has made her appealing as well.
But tennis fans are very egalitarian. They've also been cheering Kim Clijsters and others. Going ahead, there's the Dane, I understand, as well. Everybody's calling this tennis player from Denmark the Dane as if she were Hamlet. But who do you think will be in her way?
The Dane is Denmark's Caroline Wozniacki. But Serena Williams, the defending champion, I mean, I think she's the overwhelming favorite. Really, it's funny. I mean, as large a shadow as she cast, some of these other players have really come to the fore.
That's John Wertheim, senior writer for Sports Illustrated, on the story from the U.S. Open, 17-year-old Melanie Udan from Georgia. John is also author of Strokes of Genius, about the 2008 Wimbledon final between Switzerland's Roger Federer and Spain's Rafael Nadal. Oh, yeah, those two guys. They're there, too. John, thanks so much.
Pleasure.
Well, this week also marks the last outdoor swim of the year for many parts of the country. Did you know that 100 years ago, Americans largely didn't swim at all? One woman changed that. She stepped into the cold water of the English Channel on the morning of August 6, 1926, and began a half-day swim from France to England, trying to find the place where she didn't feel the cold, and time stopped.
Then it happened. For a few moments, she had not thought of her arms or her legs or the water or air. She simply listened to the sea and spoke to it not with words but thoughts, and felt the water ride over the sea bottom, and sensed the way the wind pushed the waves flat and pressed her flesh as she slipped between the sea and the air. It was like sliding into bed and finding that place, that comfortable spot between the sheet and the coverlet, her head on the pillow, and slipping into sleep.
And when 19-year-old Trudy Ederle pulled herself out of the surf 14 hours later, she became, at least briefly, the most famous person in the world. She was the first woman to swim the English Channel. She was also the fastest by 2 full hours. So why don't we know more about her? Well, a fascinating new book tells of the role Gertrude Ederle played in the history of swimming. It's called Young Woman and the Sea, How Trudy Ederle Conquered the English Channel and Inspired the World. Author Glenn Stout joins us from the studios of Vermont Public Radio. And Glenn, you write that in 1926, Trudy was probably the best swimmer in the world. She'd been in the Olympics. The English Channel was the only challenge left. But she'd tried and failed the year before. So what is it about the English Channel that made it so difficult to swim?
Well, it's only 21 miles across, but it's not a straight 21 miles. There are tremendous tides and currents that run through the channel. The weather changes drastically and very, very quickly. You can start with a day that's bright sunshine with calm water, and within 2 or 3 hours, ships can be tossed onto the beach. You know, there is a reason why more people have actually climbed Mount Everest than have swum the English Channel. Even today, most people that try to swim the channel fail.
Well, you've set the stage for us now. We've got three characters in your book. There's Trudy, there's the channel, the English Channel, and there's the sport of swimming. You actually start by telling us about a horrible accident in the East River in New York. This is a fire on an enormous steamship, the General Slocum, in 1904. What happened in those final moments when that ship was burning?
Well, what happened was this was an excursion for a church group, and the ship caught on fire, and the ship captain decided to run the boat aground rather than put it on a dock where he might have caught a dock on fire. It just took a few minutes to go up the river and run aground. But what happened was the life preservers were old and rotten. The hoses on the boat were old and split, so they couldn't put the fire out. So people began jumping off the ship, and there was one problem. At that time, women were virtually banned from swimming. If they went in the water at all, they had to wear long skirts and swimming bloomers. So the vast majority of women did not swim. Over 1,000 people died in the Slocum that day, most of them women, and in a sense it was murder. They were murdered by repression because they were not allowed to learn to swim.
If they'd only known to put their feet down, they were in
right,
shallow
that's
water.
Right, that's how fearful people were of the water when you couldn't swim, is some people drowned in water that they could have stood up in. In the wake of that, there was finally some calls that for pure safety reasons, women should learn how to swim. Everyone should learn how to swim.
Not only were people not swimming, but when they were swimming, what were they swimming?
Well, they were swimming the dog paddle, they were swimming the breaststroke, or they were swimming a rudimentary stroke that was a precursor for what we know as the freestyle today called the trudgeon. None of these were particularly easy or particularly effective.
Explain the trudgeon. There's an illustration in a dictionary that I saw, but explain what that looks like.
Yeah, the trudgeon, you would roll from one side to the other and stroke with your arm and kick with your legs in synchrony. And from the trudgeon, a new stroke at the turn of the century called the Australian crawl first, and then a variation of that, the American crawl, evolved out of that, which became what we know today as the freestyle. That was the stroke that Trudy Edderly used when she swam the channel. Interestingly enough, she was the very first person to use that stroke to swim the channel. Most channel observers thought that it was impossible for anybody to use that stroke for the number of hours it would take right to cross the channel.
Well, now, Trudy Edderly, her family emigrated from Germany. They were butchers on the Upper West Side. And how did she come to swimming?
Sort of by accident. They bought a summer home in the Highlands in New Jersey. So when she was very, very young, only 7 or 8 years old, her father trussed her up like she was a slab of meat from the butcher shop and allowed her to wade into the water while he stood on a pier holding the rope. And that's how she initially learned to swim.
We're speaking with author Glenn Stout about his terrific new book, Young Woman and the Sea, How Trudy Edderly Conquered the English Channel and Inspired the World. It tells the story of the first woman to swim the English Channel. When Trudy Edderly made her successful cross in 1926, only 5 men had done it, and she did it 2 hours faster than any of them. And Glenn, in addition to telling her story, you also give us the history of swimming because she really paved the way for other female athletes. This was in the 1920s. Female swimmers were just joining brand new organizations like the AAU, the Amateur Athletic Union, or the WSA, the Women's Swimming Association, and many of them joining because as a Trudy, they had some sort of malady. She was deaf. They had maladies to overcome, but they became almost overnight American superstars. How old was Trudy Edderly when this was happening?
She was only 13 or 14 years old, and the WSA was the first women's athletic group in the United States. It was recruiting these young girls in New York City, 12, 11, 13 years old. All of a sudden, their exploits, their photographs were in the sports pages, and almost overnight, the United States discovered that we had this class of young women, and this is in the wake of World War I, this class of young women who were athletes.
You write, not until Mark Spitz emerged in the early 70s did the sport of swimming enjoy such a figure as dominant and charismatic as either Trudy Ederle or Johnny Weissmuller, who she often swam with. And you quote a sports writer who in 1923 was trying to come up with a single greatest competitive achievement, and he had a laundry list. He concludes that no one could match Trudy Ederle, who broke 7 records in 1 year.
Yeah, she was remarkable. For a time from 1922 to 1924, almost every time she went in the water, she set a record of some kind.
Well, let's get her to the channel then. Her first attempt to swim across the English Channel was in 1925. She didn't make it. But was she poisoned by her then coach? Did her then coach slip something into a beef broth drink that she took 3/4 of the way over, as you write?
That's what she told people later. There was no question that she and her trainer at the time, Jabez Wolf, who was a man who'd tried to swim the channel and failed almost 20 times, they didn't get along. He didn't think a woman could swim the channel. And when Trudy failed, the weather did turn bad about halfway across. She got sick. She got seasick. She was vomiting. And afterwards, she very much did believe that someone, perhaps her trainer, had put something in her drink of beef tea. And that was the cause of her failure that year.
So back into the water she goes with a new coach this time, a man who had crossed the channel and was very supportive of her. She's in the water with the tugboat accompanying her on board, her coach, her family, some journalists. But then suddenly the seas change. No swimmers can pace with her because they're all becoming sick. Tell us about just how intense this swim got.
Well, there are actual newsreel footage of her swim that day. And, you know, the waves were running 4 feet high, then 5 feet high, then nearly 6 feet high. And here's this, you know, 19-year-old swimmer, this young girl swimming gamely along, while meanwhile on the tugboat, the journalists are getting sick. They can't stand it anymore. Boats all across the channel are returning to shore, yet Trudy is gamely swimming on. Her coach at the time, at a certain point, he decides that she can't make it anymore. But Trudy's father had made a promise to Trudy. Trudy had said, "Don't let anyone take me out of the water." And her father refused to allow Burgess to do so. They're following her because if you don't follow a channel swimmer, this is where it differs from, you know, climbing Mount Everest. If climbing Mount Everest, you can turn around. Well, there's no turning around if you're swimming the channel. That's why you have to have a boat with you. So if you get in trouble, you can be saved. They're arguing on the boat whether she should continue or not. And of course, Trudy is oblivious to this. She's just swimming. She's just doing what she does all the time, what she loves to do. And then at a certain point in the midst of this gale, she hears a voice call out that says, "Come out, girl. Come out of the water." And she's absolutely shocked. She doesn't feel as if she's in any trouble at all.
And what does she say?
She kind of rolls over on her back and she goes, "What for?" And everyone is completely taken aback. She's fine.
You write, the phrase, "What for?" becomes a new catchphrase for kids in America, replacing "Soja old man." And she does reach the shore and is celebrated and feted. It's stunning. You know, all she wanted to get out of it was a roadster. Her dad promised her a car. But she's one of the biggest names in the world at this point, a huge ticker tape parade back at her home in New York. But then what happened? How did Trudy Ederle sort of disappear?
Mm-hmm. It was all a bit overwhelming when she returned. She didn't know it was going to be that big a deal. And she did get the biggest ticker tape parade in the history of New York at that time. She had a small nervous breakdown within just a day or two of coming back. She went on a vaudeville tour where she would swim in a tank and talk about her channel experience, which was very, very grueling. And I think at every step from the moment she reached the shore of England, she realized that what she enjoyed was being in the water and swimming. What she did not enjoy was being this celebrity.
Well, you also write that her handlers really didn't understand the way of the world, because soon after, within days, other people, another woman crossed the channel, and then more men started to cross the channel, and they waited a little bit too long, perhaps, to cash in's not the right word, but to sort of solidify her, and she quickly was sort of elbowed out of the picture by all of these other crossings. Then she, later in life, fell and injured herself, and it sounds like she couldn't even walk for a while, much less swim.
Right. Was essentially bedridden for months and months, and that turned into years. But then she was invited to swim at the New York World's Fair by impresario Billy Rose, who put on an enormous water show. And she, just as she was determined to swim the channel, she willed herself into recovery and was able to swim again at this water show, which was sort of the last time she was really in the public view. And she began to be recognized not as a celebrity, which is what she hadn't liked, but as this pioneering athlete, which is what she truly was.
How big a name in sports do you think she is? Make the comparisons.
I think she's as big a name in sports as Jim Thorpe, as Jackie Robinson, as Babe Didrikson, as anyone who was the first. And I think it's a measure of just how important she was, how quickly she was forgotten, because she changed everything so fast. Before 1926, there were no female athletes. On the day she swims the channel, the International Olympic Committee decides to admit women's track and field to the Olympics. When she swam the English Channel and beat the men's record by 2 hours, which I think is just really remarkable, that took away any argument that could be made that women were not equipped either psychologically or physically or emotionally to compete as athletes.
That's Glenn Stout. His book is Young Woman and the Sea, How Trudy Utterly Conquered the English Channel and Inspired the World. And by the way, she passed away at the age of 98 in 2003. Glenn, thanks so much for telling the story of Trudy and swimming.
Thank you very much, Robin.